Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. In our last episode, we released part one of this fantastic conversation with Janet Horvath. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to that yet, I recommend starting with that episode before you listen to this one, since we're going to pick up right where we left off just before we started talking about the details of her new book, The Cello Still Sings. I want to talk about your parents' story, which is truly incredible. And I'm wondering, when did you decide to write this book, and what was your motivation to dedicate so much time and energy to this project?
Well, I think it was when my father blurted out a clue. So unlike some people who imagine that having a traumatic experience, it helps to talk about it. During those years, when PTSD was not known, people weren't as readily interested in talk therapy and going to a therapist, which is a great thing that is pretty openly accepted now. It wasn't then.
Yeah.
So most Holocaust survivors did not want to talk about it, their experiences. They wanted to move forward. They wanted to put that behind them, understandably, and they wanted to protect their children from those horrors. Mm-hmm. So my parents didn't speak about it, although we knew snippets of things, and I don't know if it was overhearing them talking to other survivors who were their friends, or whether it was stuff I read, or whether they accidentally said a few things, or the nightmares overnight that my father experienced. We gleaned this through our genes. They say that now there's studies that trauma is inherited genetically. Mm-hmm. So we nonetheless had the Holocaust in our genes hovering over us.
Yeah.
And although I didn't know the specifics, I sometimes wanted to know everything, and I read what I could about the Holocaust, and then I didn't want to know anything, and I wanted to move beyond. I didn't want to know, you know?
Yeah.
And then in 2009, my father's health was already failing, and I was in Toronto. I was busily trying to be the daughter that I could be, that I wasn't, because I lived here. And I was driving him to yet another doctor's appointment on a slushy January day in winter. And my father loved to talk shop. He was in the Budapest Symphony at a very young age and played with all the greatest maestros, Barbaroli and Beecham and Toscanini, and, you know, and I thought, okay, I'm going to ask him about music, what I've never asked him. And had he ever played with Leonard Bernstein? So I did. I said, mm-hmm. Papa, did you ever play with Leonard Bernstein? And suddenly it was as if his eyes went into the back of his head, like he passed out. I thought, oh, should I pull over? Like, what the heck?
Yeah.
And I kept driving. And then he like came to and said, yes, it was a very hot day. It was in the displaced persons camps in the Jewish orchestra. And he came after war, and it was just fantastic. And he played Rhapsody in Blue. And I talked to him and I said, I want to come to America. Mm. And then suddenly he started shaking his head and he stop talking.
Oh.
And before I could even get my thoughts together, it's like, what? You know, you, how come you never told me about this? How did you get instruments? Where were you in Germany? Why were you in Germany? Was my mother with you? All these questions. He wouldn't talk anymore.
Yeah.
So that night I went racing to Google. He had mentioned a singer who had a very unusual name, Henia Dermashkin-Gurko.
Uh-huh.
On the program, who was at the time a 15-year-old young girl who sang beautifully. And I started Googling and I found that name. And I found information that said this woman's daughter, who would be my age, wrote about donating a written program, a printed program of this concert. And I thought, oh, that's got to be the same person. Yeah. So I wrote to this museum. I said, I think my father was in this orchestra. And I think, you know, he played with Bernstein. And I got an immediate response. And they said, yes, Janet, the next time you come to New York, please make an appointment. We'd be happy to show you the signed program in our archives. But don't you want to see the live video testimony and the photographs? At that point, I started screaming, photographs. And sure enough, I went there and these tiny, tiny little black and white photos from 1948 showed this group. I thought it was a large orchestra, like I imagined, like the Minnesota Orchestra.
Yeah.
It was a group of 17 musicians. My father was one of two cellists, and they played two concerts with Leonard Bernstein in the largest displaced persons camps in the English zone that was under the American army, in the American zone, excuse me, where they had to divide up Europe in order to figure out how to repatriate all these refugees, what to do with the infrastructure of the countries. It was obviously a heck of a mess. So this was all over Bavaria, that the American zone was under the auspices of the American soldiers. And Lunsberg had 5,000 displaced persons.
Wow.
And he played there on a beat-up cello, beat up piano. And the picture showed my father, him, the other members. And I blew them up to poster size and took them to Toronto. Was very worried that my father would be traumatized by it or angry at me, or I didn't know.
Yeah.
How he would receive seeing these. It was the catalyst that galvanized him to finally tell me his story.
Wow. And how long before he passed away did he give you this story?
It was about 6 weeks.
Whoa.
What I did was bring the pictures, and then I got more information. I met another couple of women whose parents were in this orchestra, and they had more pictures and information. And my father saw that I was so adamantly enthusiastic about trying to trace this that he started writing late at night in a Parkinsonian scrawl in Hungarian to give me his testimony. And he insisted on reading it to me.
Wow.
And my Hungarian is all right, but my writing is atrocious in spelling. It's a very hard language. And you know, I would interrupt him, say, Dad, you know, what's that word? Janet came, why are you interrupting me every second? He said, and I thought, okay, I can't stop him. I'll just kind of sound these words out and look them up later. What did I know? My Hungarian didn't cover lynching poles, wheelbarrow, pickaxe,
yeah,
gravel, you know, pits, yeah, things like that. So,
wow. So you really got this story under the wire. I mean, the opportunity to get his story and then spend the next more than a decade researching and going back to these places and your own journey to put all the pieces together. It's amazing he shared that with you just in time.
It is amazing. I mean, he probably felt that this was the last opportunity. Maybe he felt like he was ready to tell me and that I was ready to listen,
yeah,
both of them. I feel very, very fortunate that I got the story.
And at this point, though, you had already lost your mother about a year previous to this. So how were you able to piece back together her story? Did he give you enough information to get her story also?
Spoiler alert. I had always, like a lot of young people, you feel you have plenty of time to ask these questions. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you don't. My mother had a stroke, and it was really horrible because she couldn't speak, she couldn't move, she had to be fed, diapered, carried, everything. And I knew that, I mean, they had gone through the Holocaust together. We couldn't separate them. And so I kept my parents in their condominium. I hired caregivers. We purchased all the equipment that they needed. So my father just sat by her side day after day with his arm around her. And we don't know what she understood at that point anymore, but we spoke to her, but we didn't know anything about these stories. Mm-hmm. Nothing. She didn't even share them with like her best friend.
Wow.
When she passed away, the Jewish people have an 8 days of, it's called sitting Shiva. So it's a wonderful way to make sure that people don't isolate themselves in their grief. Mm-hmm. So these 8 days, the people who have lost someone are asked to sit, and people sign up to bring them food and to visit them and to spend these 8 days remembering the loved one and making sure that the grieving person doesn't, you know, descend into depression and disappear from life, really.
Yeah.
So during those 8 days, my cousin came to the door and he was frantic. He was excited. He wanted to pull me aside and pull me to the back of the room. And I thought, I go, what the heck? You know, we're sitting here. What could be so important? And he says, I got to talk to you. I got to show you. I got to tell you. And we went back to a back room and he said, I'm really sorry, but I forgot that I had this and it was hidden. And you know how many times I've moved and, you know, but I'm really sorry, but I have the tape of your mother telling me about her experiences.
Wow.
Which he sat her down after my uncle, her brother, passed away many years before that. And she actually told him her stories. Oh. And it was not only mind-boggling to have this tape. I mean, we hadn't heard her voice for 8 years. So to hear her voice again, it was, you know, I mean, it tore our hearts out, but it took a while to wrap my head around what she was actually talking about.
Yeah.
And to actually have the tape to be able to transcribe and know what she went through was quite a gift as well.
Wow. How fortunate to be able to share both of their stories from such a different source. That's really amazing. And it's, I can tell our audience that I read this book. I really cruised right through this book because I was so fascinated by so many of the details. I mean, we can't really do it justice by just speaking about this for a short time, but there's so much information in there. And to be able to give it from both of your parents' perspective is amazing. It's a miracle that you got all of that. And it really shows in the book. I'm curious, I know that being a first generation of Holocaust survivors had so many challenges. You speak about, you know, with the fact that that generation really didn't speak about the horrors that they saw and went through. I mean, I saw this with my grandfather also. He never would share his story. And part of it was he was in a secret army, in Churchill's secret army in England, on the Allied side, obviously. And part of it is he wasn't allowed to share them for, I think, 45 or 50 years. Hmm. And then by the time he could share them, he didn't want to anymore. So many of the people from that generation came back with PTSD and all of these horrors that they witnessed, and they were not able to express themselves. And I think it manifested itself in their lifestyles in so many different ways. And I think for you growing up as a direct descendant of this, not just feeling the horror of that, being a child of that, but the pressure that you had to be successful from your parents had to be amazing, because after losing so many people in that war and having children, that was the way to keep the generation going, which is something that was obviously not intended by Hitler. Right. So what a gift to be able to have this next generation. And you write about the incredibly high standards your parents placed on you to succeed. Mm-hmm. Even listening to you practicing and hollering corrections at you through the door, slow down, it's out of tune. And you also write about playing for your father in the last week of his life when he was lying in bed. And after you finished playing, he gave you a litany of corrections down to the measure number. I'm curious, did you feel this pressure from them to become a professional musician, to continue this legacy? Did you feel pressured to go down this road for your own journey, which obviously you've been incredibly successful, but I'm wondering how that, what that dynamic was like growing up.
I don't think it was ever verbalized, because sometimes I would say, I'm a tiny person with tiny hands, and people thought I could never play the cello. And I sometimes, when I was dragging it around, I would say to my mother, "This is your fault," you know, and she would laugh at me and said, "No, you were so ambitious. You wanted it. You did it." But unspoken, a lot of my generation feel that we felt like we had to live for those who didn't, and we had to succeed in ways that our parents couldn't. And we had to, you know, attain these things. I mean, a lot of my friends whose parents are Holocaust survivors are very type A. We're really, you know, perfectionists. We, you know, have to do everything the best we can possibly do them. We certainly didn't want to cause our parents pain, any further pain.
Yeah.
So we were, some of us were the best behaved young children on the planet. So I wonder, there are times when I wonder if I would have become a cellist. I love to write. And I have written quite a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe I would have become a writer. I don't know. But I do know that I had to step into my father's shoes.
Yeah. How did this affect the way you raised your own child?
My son turns out to be quite musical too, but I never pressured him. I didn't want him to feel forced in a certain direction.
Yeah.
So he loves music, but he's a technology professional. He's brilliant and he's very happy with that field. And he enjoys music for the love of it. And that's great. I didn't want him to have the scars that I had, but I'm sure that some of my anxiety and worries are totally from my father, that I dream up all the dreadful disasters that could happen, because they did for my parents. Their lives were upended in ways that no one could have ever imagined or anticipated. They lost everything more than once. And so I appreciate incredibly, I get in the shower and I think, okay, I have a hot shower. I have some sweet smelling soap. I have a nice bed to sleep in. I have a roof over my head. I don't have to sleep in the outside in the dirt covered in lice. Like, you know, I mean, it's impossible to imagine what my father went through. But I'm a worrier. And I believe that that anxiety of, okay, we got to stay together. We can't do this. We can't do that. We have to be careful. Those things I fight against. I try to extend myself in ways to try stuff that's new, but it's hard for me.
Yeah. So your parents came to Canada and they were allowed in the country because they signed up to be farmers and they had to work in fields that they were not accustomed to working in. Even your father, after acquiring this incredible cello for $100, this Italian cello that he then dragged with him all over war-torn, displaced person camps, and then made it to Canada because that's where they were welcome, but then had to be a farmer and be in a small town before they could make it to Toronto. I mean, it seems that the cello is really what gave him purpose to continue forward and to drive forward and to create a new life and be able to move past the horrors of the past. And I think that's what this book really speaks to so well about both of your parents finding their path back to music that was their roots that they were grounded in.
Yep. I really feel that, of course, there's hundreds and hundreds of wonderful books about the Holocaust, about people's experiences, and also about World War II soldiers and people who really suffered. But what isn't examined as much is how people put their lives back together, what it was like to feel like you were stateless. You couldn't go, quote unquote, home. There was no home to go back to. And you had no identity. you had no papers to say who you were. Mm-hmm. So they had to acquire these things through arduous filings of paperwork and trying to find a country that would take them. And so many people had to start over with strange customs, strange foods, strange languages. Very few countries would take refugees, including this country. Yeah. That's why my parents ended up in Canada. And the only way Canada would take people was when they had professions that were needed in Canada. And that was farming and seamstress. My mother said she was a seamstress, and she was a good sewer at that time.
Yeah.
You had to have somebody sponsor you, to speak for you, to say you wouldn't become a burden to the government. And so that's how they ended up in Hamilton, Ontario, which is about an hour away from Toronto, where there was no classical music to speak of at the time. And they struggled mightily. And we have very few books that examine what that must have felt like. And I was lucky enough to have bags of letters attesting to their homesickness and wondering if they should go back to Hungary and what they should do, and yearning to play and not being able to play because he couldn't join the union for a couple of years, that sort of thing. So I think it's really helpful for people to have that story, because we have so many refugees today. We still have immigrants and people fleeing strife in their own countries, obviously Ukraine and other places, where that is the experience of people. And the only way we can actually have any kind of empathy for them is to read about it, learn about it, try to experience it vicariously through a story.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you feel like you'd like to share with our audience about this story before we tell them where they can find this incredible book?
Well, I think I'm very proud of the last section of the book, which is two things. The book ends up being bookended because 70 years after my father played with Leonard Bernstein, the town of Lundsberg decided to commemorate that concert with Leonard Bernstein with a concert and reconciliation in that city. And I was invited to play solo with a German youth orchestra there. And I played Kol Nidre, which is a famous piece by Max Bruch, with a German orchestra in the place my father played 70 years to the day later, which happened to be, it coincided with the Leonard Bernstein 100th birthday celebrations that year, 2018. Uh-huh. It was an out-of-body experience for those of us that were there, about 40 of us whose parents were in that DP camp, or some of us who were born there in Lundsberg during those years. It was such a cathartic experience. So that ends the book in a really uplifting way. I want people to know that there's a lot of humor and a lot of telling about music, my life in music, stories. But then I end the book with a Nazi euphemism dictionary. So for every letter of the alphabet, I use a euphemism that was used then, but I weave in euphemisms that are used now that try to pull the wool over people's eyes, that don't tell the truth.
Yeah.
And for us to be really aware that that can so easily happen again. It's a slippery slope where people start using lies, or, you know, or this language to couch these horrific activities in verbiage that isn't telling the truth about what's actually going to happen or is happening or could happen.
Yeah, using euphemisms to diminish people's value is where it really starts, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So the book comes out on February 28th. So where will people be able to find it? Is this something that people can get now, or explain a little bit about where this stands? Because I know it's coming up and it'll be about a month from when this podcast airs that it will be released.
So it's already available for pre-sales, and pre-sales are really critical for your ranking on Amazon and places like that, that if there is an indication of demand that that really helps the author. So it's available right now for pre-sales. You can get it Amazon and also Barnes & Noble, and I think Indigo in Canada. And if a bookstore would like to order it, it's on Ingram's already.
Okay.
And then once it's available, I'm hoping not only will Amazon and Barnes & Noble and some other places sell it, but it'll be hopefully available in bookstores and people who have book clubs can order it. I'd be happy to speak if people want. That would be great to be able to answer questions. And so I'm hoping that it reaches a good audience.
Well, in the pre-sale, does that mean you can get the electronic version now, or do you still have to wait until February 28th in the pre-sale period?
Yeah, the Kindle is on sale right now for very little, $2.99, but the links won't be available till the 28th.
Okay. Okay, so you can get a deal now, but then you'll get it on the day that it releases.
Right.
Well, I feel fortunate that I had the opportunity to read this book and speak to you about this incredible story and your own amazing journey of dealing with your hearing loss. Is that the right term, hearing loss? Or
no, I would tell people I could hear so well I could be a spy.
So it's the opposite. You know?
Yeah, so hearing injury, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
And then your own journey back to the place 70 years later where your father had performed with Leonard Bernstein after going through your own hurdles of being able to hear and play the cello yourself. So it's really an incredible story. And I encourage anybody who's interested to please go and order this. And if you order it early, that's even better for Janet. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you so much for letting me tell this story. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much to Janet Horvath for this interview, and thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Janet and her books, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Atlanta-based cellist Mary Beth Bryant and talk extensively about her Suzuki training and the teaching style she brings to her highly sought-after private studio. We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecelosherpa.com, or tweet them at us at @thecelosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.